KBTC, a viewer-supported community service of Bates Technical College.
From KBTC Public Television Studios in Tacoma, Washington, welcome to the Steve on the Street podcast, a closer look behind the headlines as public policy and current affairs impact the real lives of real people.
Hello, and welcome to the Steve on the Street podcast, produced by KBTC Public Television's weekly public affairs program, Northwest Now. I'm your host, reporter, and photojournalist Steve Kiggins. Today's episode focuses on government transparency, access to public records, and specifically, how the issue impacts Washington State citizens who were separated from their families and institutionalized by the state into what were once called state custodial schools. So, decades ago, those institutions are where young people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were often taken in by the state, which promised families the schools were the only place their loved ones would get the care and education they needed. Of course, this was all happening around the same time of the American eugenics movement, but in early March 2024, Washington state lawmakers agreed to save thousands of historic medical records that were at risk of being destroyed and lost forever. Take a listen to our coverage where we speak with a woman whose journey through access to public records helped her learn everything she could about a family member who became custody of the state almost a century ago. Lawmakers in Olympia approved a bill that preserves and catalogs thousands of hospital records found inside dilapidated buildings at the state's Lakeland Village residential facility in Spokane County. We're talking somewhere in the order of 3,000 boxes filled with these documents that are decades old. These documents tell the stories of Washington state citizens who were separated from their families and institutionalized. Now, these records were slated to be destroyed, but that's until public record advocates sounded the alarm.
My great aunt is Grace Buchanan. There's a picture of Grace.
Leslie Whiting is passionate about family history. She testified during a January Senate hearing, sharing what she learned thanks to access to state records about a long-lost relative she met only once.
Grace was sterilized. Grace was committed to the state custodial school by her mother on June 20th, 1929. She was 14 years old.
Grace's story is just one of an untold number of histories waiting to be revealed, but only if Washington State protect and make publicly available patient records.
I cried, you know. It just changed me that I want to make sure people knew who she was.
I think society was afraid of people with developmental disabilities.
Stacy Dim, executive director of the ARC of Washington State, a nonprofit fighting for intellectual and developmentally disabled communities' civil liberties, says records discovered at Lakeland Village may date back more than a century, and inside them, she says, likely describe a dark history of eugenics, mistreatment, and possibly reveal branches to severed family trees.
I mean, I've met 70-year-olds who didn't know they had a sibling until their parents passed away, and then they discover that they have a sibling at a state institution they didn't know about.
Her efforts to save patient records from destruction awarded Dim and Lakeland Village Superintendent Tim Gerlitz with a key award from the Washington Coalition for Open Government. The bill approved by lawmakers instructs state agencies and the University of Washington to create a preservation plan and submit a budget in 2025. Next year, advocates hope lawmakers approve funding to add identifying information on 900 Lakeland Cemetery headstones that today display only a number stamped into concrete.
It wasn't just children who had, you know, what they considered feeble-minded, but kids who were troublemakers.
Whiting's research moved beyond her Aunt Grace. She's reaching out to strangers who may not even know about family members who became patients under the state's care.
What a tragedy if you wipe off someone's story, you know, that their life had meaning, that they want people to know, hey, I was here.
In Seattle, Steve Kiggins, Northwest Now. Next on the podcast, we're going to dive deeper into Leslie Whiting's interview where she shares why it's so important to find out more information about her great aunt Grace and how it propelled her testimony in front of a state Senate hearing. What compelled you testify in front of the Senate hearing?
Well, as I told him a little bit, like in 2012, I was looking up some census records because I do family history. And so I couldn't find my great grandmother. So I found Grace on the 1930 census at the state custodial school. And at the time, I didn't know anything about that. And so I started doing the research and seeing what exactly the state custodial school was. And
likely, I would guess maybe your family either didn't know or couldn't tell you exactly what happened to Grace.
Well, anybody who knew anything was gone. You know, my dad was still alive. He knew nothing. My dad was born in 1930. My uncle, my dad's little brother, knew nothing. My grandpa would have known because I've got pictures of him visiting Grace at the state custodial school. I didn't have them then, but I've gotten a hold of like a second cousin, and she's got her grandmother's old pictures, and I was able to tell her somewhat about what happened to our great aunt Grace. We share the same great aunt. And so I just decided to see if I could find the records. And so I got a hold of the disclosure officer over at Lakeland Village. And he said, well, let me get back to you when I'll look for these records. And he got back to me. And, you know, I had to say, I'm her closest living relative. She had no children. Anybody who's alive would have been, you know, a close relative is gone. So I'm her nearest relative. Right. And so he found them and told me, well, I'll send you what I think would be interesting to you. And I told him, I want everything, copy everything for me. And he did. And not only did I get paperwork, you know, like different records, but I got correspondence that family had written to Grace, and I don't know why they stored them, which is great they did. You know, I kind of even wondered, did she even get to read them? But these letters are stored there, and also letters that she wrote to the facility.
So, but for these records, you had no surviving family members that could fill in these gaps. So, but for these records,
yeah,
you would know nothing.
I would know nothing. I remember meeting my great aunt Grace once at my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. She came down from Alaska because she was fishing up in Alaska. Her and her husband had a fishing boat, and they'd been fishing up in Alaska. And I'd never, that I can remember, because I moved from Washington to California when I was 2. For 10 years, I lived in California, then came back when I was 12. And we had, you know, we're living around the grandparents. And that's the first time I can remember ever, first and only time I can remember ever meeting her. And I was, you know, surprised at how much she looked like my grandpa. And also, she had a tattoo on her arm. And back in the 60s, women did not have tattoos. You know, it was not common for a woman to have a tattoo. So it was kind of because she was in the fishing industry. So I thought she was pretty interesting. So
certainly she was maybe painting some interesting pictures in your mind about who this woman was and what kind of life she lived.
Yeah. And especially, you know, a woman out there fishing up in Alaska. I thought that was, you know, unique.
You told senators that this changed your life. Help me understand that emotion. How did finding this information about your great aunt impact you?
I felt how, you know, I cried, you know, it just changed me that I want to make sure people knew who she was, that her life had meaning, that what she went through, she didn't just go through for nothing. On the 1930 census at the State Custodial School, there is 1,150 kids, young adults, give or take, you know, that number on the census record. And each one of them has a story to be told. I found three of them that died there. Well, there's more that died there, but I just looked up three of the younger kids that were there. And one of them was an Elmer Sperry. And he went there when he was 4 years old. And then he died when he was 12. 8 years, 10 months, and 8 days. And so he was 4 years old when somebody brought him there. That's all he knew. And so if those records are destroyed, all that's left of his life is a census record and a death certificate and maybe a birth certificate. I've looked on Ancestry.com. I've looked on Family Search to see, is he connected to any family anywhere? And I haven't found him there. You know, I will connect him, but he's got a story to tell. You know, the people who lived there have a story to tell. Some lived and died there, and they're out buried in a cemetery where there's just, like I sent you that brick, a brick with a number on it. And they're going to work on, hopefully, they can get a name and a date. So somebody will know that they were there. Because otherwise, you've got to look on a census record or a death record.
But for your work... Your kids that, and you, but for your work, your children and your grandchildren might not even remember great Aunt Grace.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the point here, right? The point is she has a story and her family.
She has a story, and I didn't know her story. And she died in like 1986. And I was in Washington in 1986. I didn't know she needed me, and she needed me. And I think with learning more about Grace is kind of looking around and see who else needs me, that there may be other people who, you know, it's made me more compassionate and more understanding, and even looking at people and thinking, what's your story? You know, what have you been through to be where you are today? You know, I look at my grandpa, who's his story. He worked hard to change the outcome of his story, of losing his dad and being thrown into poverty. He's just was an amazing man, and his siblings too worked really hard. But it seemed like poor little Grace was at the tail end, and at the time everybody else was getting married and kind of busy with their family. And when they did try to get her, they couldn't get her out of the system until she was sterilized, and then she was deemed worthy to go. You know, she was no longer a risk to society or a menace to society. And that's one of the things.
Which is really language that's no doubt really difficult to read and hear.
Oh, yes. Because she writes to the school after she's been out asking why this happened to me. You know,
and no answers to that.
Well, there is. There was a state law.
Probably very clinical. This is, we were working within the purview of our authority, and we did what we thought was right.
And to save, you know, society from her kind, which I am her kind. You know, I that's my family. You know, this is part of Washington state history. Well, part of our nation's history, the whole eugenics program. You know, we think of Hitler and we're so appalled with what he was trying to do. He got the idea from the United States. You know, it's what was going on, you know, in the 20s and 30s. So trying, you know, they had the better baby contest at the Puyallup Fair. You know, you could take your baby and hopefully your baby would get high marks. So that was what was happening, you know, in our country at the time.
Yeah. Do you ever look back, step back from all of your work and think, how in the world did I achieve all of this? The piles of paperwork and the visits you've shared with Lakeland Village, like, Most people don't go anywhere near the tenacity that you've shown.
I can't stop. I just feel a real drive to do it, to tell Grace's story. I love family history, and there's been studies done that children who know about their families, like Emory University did a study, and children who know who their family stories are able to deal with life's challenges better than kids who don't. And they came to find out that they knew that they were part of something bigger than this themselves. And when, you know, I shared those stories and with my family and my grandkids and tell them, you can do hard things because these people did these hard things. You know, you don't just throw in the towel. Life is hard, but that doesn't mean you give up. So
I met Leslie Whiting after watching her Senate testimony, and I knew I had to hunt her down to help share her perspective. Now, next is my conversation with Stacey Dim. You remember she's the executive director of the ARC of Washington State, and she shares some history about the organization and offers more insight into what else could be found inside these neglected records.
Well, the ARC was started by a group of parents who cared a lot about how their children were cared for in our state institutions. Because back in 1936, when the ARC was formed, upon diagnosis, early on, children were very automatically placed in one of our state institutions.
Just ripped from their family.
Just taken from their families and told, this is the only way. You should never look back. We'll take care of your child. It'll be the only way they can get access to education, to training. You should pretend like you haven't had this child in your family before. And there was even at our state institutions, our oldest, Lakeland Village, a back door with a bell where you could drop off your baby. And that bell is still there.
You're kidding.
It's still there. So when parents started to form a group and find each other because they didn't want to lose track of their child.
They knew they weren't alone.
Yeah. And it's not uncommon to hear stories of families where either the mom or the dad would go regularly visit, but they didn't tell the rest of the family. They didn't tell the other children even, but they would donate money or they would go on Sundays. And those families, as they started to get together, would talk about how do we improve care? Because back then, your children, you gave up custody of your children. They became wards of the state. They were early on considered inmates. That's what the records will show in the late 1890s and early 1900s. They were registered as inmates of the state.
So for 50 years or so, they didn't give up their children. The children were taken.
They were. They didn't. It's not like somebody came and took them away. You had to voluntarily give your children up, but you were told this was really the only option.
This is the way your child will get what they need.
Yeah. If you love your child, you'll place them in an institution. And that went on through the 60s and 70s. I'm also a sibling. My sister has developmental disabilities. And when she was born with Down syndrome in 1964, my parents were told, you should immediately place your child at Fircrest in Seattle. That's the only way she'll get access to education. And that was in 1964.
This is recent memory.
It was in my lifetime.
Right.
We didn't have mandatory access to public school until the late 1970s, which is when I was graduating from high school. And my sister wasn't allowed to go to school with me until my senior year. And even then, she was in a portable at the back of the campus.
Segregated.
Segregated.
Out of sight, maybe out of mind. What was the goal from the state, do you think?
The goal for the state?
Since 1890 or so.
Yeah. I don't know that I can speak to that.
Yeah.
I think society was afraid of people with developmental disabilities. I think it was very uncomfortable for them. I think that the language that we used reflects that. Imbeciles, idiots, people with loathsome and contagious diseases. That's what the statutory language is. And then as the civil rights movement happened in the 60s, there's no question that the racial justice movement impacted what we now call the disability justice movement. And kids with disabilities were allowed in public schools for the first time at the same time that children, black children, were allowed in school in the South. It was related directly. I didn't know how much my sister had an influence on me, but I do know that I have a vivid memory as we were driving when we lived in California, when the law passed, the federal law passed, the children with disabilities were required to be in public school. My mom shouted with glee and pulled over and said, "We got to get a lawyer. She can go to school." Like, that's a vivid memory for me.
Wow.
And
vindication.
That's when everything shifted. Everybody decided, the parents decided, well, if they can go to public school, they don't need to be in a state institution.
How did you discover these records? You must have known there were records of some kind, but how did this kind of land in your lap?
I was able to meet with the superintendent, Tim Gerlitz. Superintendent Tim Gerlitz was very open to showing people around. And because he's new, I think just to get a sense of, these are all my facilities, what's in all these rooms, what do I have here that I'm managing? He found an old building that is due to be destroyed, that has floors of records on them from as early as the 1890s. He invited me in, actually very friendly, and said, "You're not going to believe this book that I found." And it looked like a Harry Potter book. It's bound in red leather. And he opened it up, and it's the first registrations of children that came into the institution in the turn of the century, in the 1900s. Their conditions, their families, what city they came from, how old they were. Just pages and pages and pages. And I was just stuck in a room. And he had on the floor old film footage with a rickety projector that he was trying to put back together so that he could see some of the film that had been taken of residence over time. And he was looking at all the stories that are in those records that are sitting unprotected in a hot room with rodents infested in the room. And he was taking great care. He also told me about the 900 unmarked graves that are at Lakeland Village. Individuals who are buried there over time in the state's care that are remembered only by a very small stone with a number on it. And that number corresponds to a book that has their name in it.
That's somewhere in one of these boxes, in one of these buildings that's leaking and rotting and accumulating rot.
Yeah. And he took great effort, really, to reach out to the state, to go to the archaeological societies nearby, to go to the archives and find ways to preserve those records, but not just box them up and take them away, but could we have some money for research for people to come and really look through and read and categorize the records, digitize them, so we don't spend thousands of dollars storing them in a room, and then making sense of them, because they do tell the story of the treatment of people with developmental disabilities historically over 100 years at least, and that's an important story to tell.
You talked a little bit about mistreatment of some of the patients, some of the folks that were there. I don't know if patients is the right word for that.
Was then. Now we call them residents.
Certainly.
Yeah.
But the records were mistreated as well. I mean,
yeah.
If there's this arbitrary number, 75 years of retention, I mean, if there's documents there that are 100 years old, I mean, that's not even a policy that's really enforced.
No. And what we do know, they'll tell a history of eugenics. They'll tell a history of cutting the Achilles tendon of someone who was a chronic runner. They'll tell the history of people with behavioral issues who were paddled, that had a special paddle with 14 holes in it to make sure that it had impact. It tells the story of individuals not getting access to medical care. It tells a lot of stories that under legal government policy, in terms of care and treatment, we need to be accountable for and have a truth and reconciliation process around that.
You're just skimming the surface there, aren't you? We're talking like sterilization.
Forced sterilizations.
Horrendous things.
Yeah. There are many families who will be able to trace their history and say they were writing the state institution saying they're ready to take their family member back. And the condition was maybe, but we've got to sterilize them first because they're a nuisance to society otherwise.
So the battle is now what? To preserve these records and make them open.
Yes.
Why is that so important to have access to those pieces of information?
I think it's really haunting for, I mean, I've met 70-year-olds who didn't know they had a sibling until their parents passed away. And then they discover that they have a sibling at a state institution they didn't know about, or they had a vague memory of, like their sibling disappeared at age 4 or 5. And it's a missing part of who you are as a family and your identity. And it's a moving thing to watch in a family to want to reclaim their family member and their history and understand it. We all go through that. We all want a sense of who are we? And if this is part of my history, I want to understand.
All the warm, fuzzy memories and the dark ones. Especially when they're in custody of the state, both the person and the story that's on record.
In a box, in an attic, that you can't figure out where they're at. So it's the right thing to do to make that available so that families can have access to that information, but also to be able to tell a more cohesive story so that we don't repeat history. And I think there is value, just like we are going through now with understanding what we did in Indian schools or what we did through Japanese internment, our discovery that we medically experimented on some of our prisoners, our history will be similar. I know they will be. We are in that same category of thinking for society that we didn't belong. Our family members didn't belong.
And you know, in the depths of your soul and heart, that they do.
Yeah, I know that in my soul and heart.
Every family does.
Every day.
Every family.
Yes. Yes. I think many of our citizens do too. I think they just aren't aware.
Washington State is not the only place in America now coming to grips with how we once treated some of our most vulnerable populations. Dim says the recent actions in our state legislature to step in the right direction to fund the study of these historic records and recognize those who were once removed from our society and can finally be treated with the respect and dignity they deserve. So, thanks again to Leslie Whiting, and also thanks to Stacey Dim for sharing their time and stories so we can better understand. And also, thanks to you for taking the time and interest to spend some time listening to the Steve on the Street podcast. It's always nice to have you. I'm Steve Kiggins from Northwest Now. We'll see you next time. Cheers.